Hello and welcome to Changing the Record, the podcast brought to you by the Talking About My Generation news team, who are setting the record straight on growing older in Greater Manchester.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Changing the Record podcast. My name is Martin Hazelhurst and I'm a reporter with Talking About My Generation. Today we're joined by Brian Groom. Brian is the author of Northerners, a history of the North and Northerners from the last ice age to the present day. I'll be talking to Brian about the book and also his forthcoming sequel called Simply Made in Manchester. Good afternoon, Brian. It's good of you to come and talk to my generation.
Good afternoon, firstly, Martin. A pleasure to talk to you.
I want to say how much I enjoyed the book. I mean, I read it in a day, and as a confirmed Northerner myself, it was great to put what is our unique heritage and culture in what you show to be a complex historical context. Firstly, I'd like to know what motivated you to write the book.
Yeah, well, the background is that as a kid, I was absolutely mad on history. I was reading History Today when I was age 12 and all that. But I kind of went off it a bit in my late teenage years and did English at university. But then my career was as a journalist, which is a bit like doing history in real time. And I was, as I was getting towards retirement age and I started thinking about why don't I write a book, it was just I specialise as a journalist as well in British and regional affairs, and I'm a Northerner. So if you add all those things together, when you're thinking of a book, it's a natural thing to start thinking about the North. I started thinking about it about 10 years ago, and I was astonished to discover that it only ever been done once before. There had only been one previously published history, general history of the North of England, and that was in 1990. So it seemed like a gap and an opportunity.
Excellent. I mean, I guess, you know, coming to the book, the first thing in my mind was, what is a Northerner? What is the North? Because it's, and I was reminded of a Norwegian friend of mine once said to me, how can you call yourself a Northerner? If I look at a map of Britain, you're barely halfway up.
Yes.
And I sort of thinking, well, how do we define North? And how did you define the North and Northerners?
Well, that would be the view that people on Tyneside would have. Would have it that people are in Lancashire and Yorkshire in the Midlands. Yeah. It's these questions of identity are often quite fraught. But as you know from reading the book, I decided to take a very kind of liberal, inclusive approach. So I kind of treated it as self-defining, that a Northerner is somebody who thinks of themselves as a Northerner, whether they're born in the region or not. And the North is places where the people who live there think they're in the North, not where somebody else thinks they are. So it's not precise. I couldn't draw you a precise map of that. There is the two sides of the sea, and the Scottish border was largely fixed in 1237. So, but there is this great, great wodge of debatable land in the south, where it borders on the Midlands. So that is where most of the debate happens.
My wife, is from Alnwick. So she really disagrees with me to say I'm a Northerner.
Yes,
she says I'm from the North, she says. And she is.
You can understand it. You can understand why people in the North, in Northeast particularly, have a special sense of Northerners. They're that bit further cut off. They're a conurbation that's kind of cut off from the other big conurbations, and it's further north than anywhere else. So you can understand why they think that way.
Yeah, I can. I can understand her. I'm still a Northerner though. And we learn, what we learn from the book is it is that the North is comparatively, by the size of Great Britain, a big area, and has a huge different number of peoples and cultures and identities, and through time these have merged. In writing the book, did you think and discover anything you thought was a characteristic of Northerners. Who are Northerners? And is there anything that unites us other than a resentment of the South?
Yeah, I mean, I've stayed a bit clear of the kind of trying to characterize a typical northerner, because I think that the northerners often suffered from caricatures of what a northerner is, sometimes told by northerners themselves for good self-affirming reasons. Often regions that are far from the center of power develop their own mythology and their own sense of identity and their own stories and their own belief in the kind of characters they have. It's not to see not to say that there aren't any characteristically northern characteristics, but I think it's complex and it's multi-layered. We've already talked about, the what is a northerner bit of it. It's a There are so many rivalries and identity issues around the North that I'm a bit wary of attempts to sum up, because there have been so many cliches about Northern England.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'd like to think we're just all great people, but never mind. I want to ask you just three or four things, three or four points in the book. I'd like to ask you a bit more about things that came out at me as interesting things that I'd never thought of before. The first one is early in the book. I mean, you're talking about Northumbria and how what a hot, cultural hotspot it was, and how it was. And then you talk about the Viking raids and Viking invasions, and you say, had it not been for the Viking raids, that Great Britain could have been a north-centered country. And that kind of shut it out at me, and it was a lovely thought. Can you tell a bit more about that?
Yes, well, it's a bit more than just the Vikings. It was kind of the Norman invasion as well, kind of shifted England's whole geostrategic position from relations with Norway and the Baltic states and the North and Scandinavia generally, to being more tied in with Central Europe. And obviously, the end of the Kingdom of Northumbria removed independent government from the northern half of England and southern Scotland. It's just one, it's one of history's what ifs, that if all those things hadn't happened, how would it have developed? Could it have been, if the Kingdom of Northumbria still existed in some form, we'd be talking about a country that covered the northern half of England and much of Scotland as well, headquarters somewhere else. As it is, we've turned into a southern focused country with its headquarters in its capital in London. But history didn't necessarily have to go that way.
No, because it happened again. You talk about prior to 1237 and the Scotland occupying large parts
Yes, could have happened the other way
of
around.
what now is
Yes,
the North.
with Scotland taking over
And
a good chunk of.
that seemed, for me, there was resonances of kind of things we say in jest now about, well, we could have get rid of the Tories if we all went to live in Scotland, went to join Scotland. And had a huge country coming down here. Well, that was interesting. That was,
Yeah,
I mean,
one thing.
you can't help thinking, gosh, all these what ifs, that there are so many what ifs that I think the book actually told me a lot about that I didn't know already.
Yeah, one thing I found, I think, when I worked in Scotland for 10 years, is that a lot of people from the north of England either spend time living in Scotland or feel a close affinity with it. And there is a school of thought that says if only we could recreate the Kingdom of Northumbria and have a very different place from south of England. But the Scots, in my experience, tend to see a border. They tend more to see it as Scotland and England, and not be not lot don't necessarily differentiate between Northern England and Southern England or the
No.
Midlands or whatever.
I have a lot of Scottish friends, and I think they're very clear. about what Scotland is and what England is. I was also thinking about, I mean, it's hard in the 21st century. You can't think about the North in a way without thinking about what we now call the North-South divide and the economic disparities and power disparities and government thing. When do you think this emerged, and when do you think it originated? Because you have William the Conqueror, you've got the Tudors, you've got Victorian England. Did this start to emerge quite early, or is this a much more recent?
Very early indeed. I mean, I some kind of North-South divide existed as far back as I could go. And arguably, it's the result of geography and geology. Some historians in the past have talked about a divided Britain into a highland and lowland zone, going diagonally across, and kind of north and west of that, you tend to get higher ground, mountains, thinner soils, suitable for raising sheep or sometimes cattle. You tended to get isolated farms or small villages forming. But south and east of that line, you tend more likely to get arable farms, bigger villages forming. There's early evidence of pottery in those places. So the suggestion is that it was a wealthier part of the landmass from quite an early point. And for most of history, it's an oversimplification. It's obviously there are sort of the Great Plains in the eastern part of the north as well, but there is something in it. The geology has probably held back the north economically for most of its history. But then, come the Industrial Revolution, those factors went into reverse, and suddenly the things that were holding the north back were an advantage: rivers, streams, coal, iron, things like that were an advantage. So for about 150 years, it was the fastest growing part of Britain. It's kind of gone back into reverse over the past century, but there's still hopes now of kind of at least capturing some of those natural resources and creating some kind of ecological industry out of that.
But did the Industrial Revolution actually reverse the economic disparities, or was it that real wealth and real capital was in the South still?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. It narrowed the gap. It was for a period where the new wealth was being created, but there was always more established wealth in the South. You look at the data for millionaires, the tax data for millionaires. There are far more millionaires always have been in the southeast of England than there have been in the North, even throughout the Industrial Revolution.
I think that was what was when we read about the Industrial Revolution is possibly something I've read more about than anything. And coming from Wigan and Rochdale, you can't not have an interest in what was happening during the Industrial Revolution. I've even got pages and pages and books of notes about a detective story starring Samuel Bamford, who was a poet from Middleton. He was
Indeed,
going to be my detective, and it was a murder in 1817. And so I kind of, for a
He
short
made a
period
good
after every
detective, I
time,
think. Yes.
sorry?
He'd have made a very interesting
He would
detective,
have been a
yes.
brilliant detective. He would. Yeah, for a short period after retiring, I kind of immersed myself in this period, and there's still a pile of books here that were part of that. But it always it kind of annoys and interests me that, yes, the North was the industrial area, the North was producing all the wealth, and yet there was something so entrenched in the North-South divide that it never really tipped over.
No, it didn't. It in the I obviously I'm going to this in more detail in the new book. There was a kind of Manchester moment around the 1840s when it was setting the pace politically as well as economically, with the drive for ending the Corn Laws and stuff like that. A lot of radical movements coming out of Manchester, quite exciting place. But it and he did achieve the end of the Corn Laws and establish free trade as the orthodoxy in Britain for decades thereafter. But it kind of gave up after that. The spotlight switched as the century went on. It moved first to Birmingham under Joseph Chamberlain, who did lots of municipal enterprises. And then eventually, by the end of the 19th century, London was getting its act together in a big way and turning itself into the financing centre for the British Empire. That was what was driving its growth at that point. So there was a brief period when Manchester and the area around it, as people used to say, either what Manchester thinks today the world does tomorrow, or some versions of it are what Lancashire thinks today the world thinks tomorrow. It did seem to be setting the pace, but it didn't last all that long.
No, it didn't. And that's sad. And I guess the other bit in your book about the Industrial Revolution is the relationship with slavery, which is something which I've only just starting to read more about. And quite obviously, cotton was a slave product and things. But I'm guessing it had a big impact on the industrialization that these cheap products were available.
It's one of strange point of history that the northwest of England should become the global centre for an industry whose raw material was on the other side of the world. That was pretty odd, and it was because there were a number of reasons for it. One is it kind of had an established cottage-based woolen and linen textile industry before, so it already had some kind of infrastructure in that industry. Had these natural advantages. I talked about rivers and streams for water power and things like that, and easy sources of coal and iron and chemicals. But it also is because it was close to Liverpool, giving access to slaver and cotton first in the West Indies and later from the Americas very cheaply. And one of the big economic history debates is what impact that had. Could it all happen without that? Hard to say. There have been a lot of studies, attempts to put numbers on it. They mostly come to the view that slavery and the slave-related industries probably accounted for up to 10% of investment and economic growth in the Industrial Revolution. So not overwhelming, but certainly a big enabling part of it.
Yeah, and even that's not a simple story. Coming from Rochdale, you're aware of the Rochdale and other Lancashire cotton workers refusing to touch Confederate cotton.
Yes.
So the impact that had on
it's a very mixed picture. That that was one thing I was fascinated to discover in researching the book. That, and this is true of Britain generally, but more so in the Northwest probably. That in the cotton famine happened in the 1860s, partly because there's too much cotton in the world and partly because the American Civil War was going on and there was a blockade of southern grown cotton. Now, in the early stages of the war, the tendency in Britain, including in most of the mill towns, was to support the South in the American Civil War, the source of their cotton. There were big marches in Oldham and Ashton and places like that, because their work was grinding to a halt and they're in support of getting the cotton, and obviously Liverpool as well, the main cotton importing port. But then Rochdale was a bit of an exception, partly because it was the home of the cooperative movement, and it was more conscious, I think, of social issues like that. But then, after about 3 years into the war, in 1862, when President Lincoln redefined his war aim as the abolition of slavery, which it hadn't been up to that point. So before that, people had seen it as a sort of fight for independence. But once the North's, America's war against secession by the South became in favor of the abolition of slavery, that had resonance in Britain because Britain had already done it a few decades earlier. So it did start to gain some traction. and you started seeing a lot of pro-North meetings, including the famous one at Manchester Free Trade Hall. But there was even one in Liverpool that about 3,500 people attended.
Really? Because I'd always assumed Liverpool was quite staunchly pro-Confederate.
Well, it was predominantly, but it wasn't immune to the abolitionist movement.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm going to move on to something else that stood out. About the comparisons, not a big deal of it, but you do make comparisons, possible comparisons between the kind of the royalist parliamentarian support in late 1640s with Brexit in 2016. I mean, I'm interested to know a little bit more about it. Unfortunately, all it made me think was I spent days upon days upon days being insulted on the street in Rochdale. And I just thought, does that mean that it was all a waste of time? And what was actually faced with were historical forces going back hundreds of years. I'm interested, you talk about this kind of social conservatism that particularly, I think you're thinking particularly of Lancashire, aren't you? Which was quite strongly royalist in,
It was quite a strong royalist area. It's not an exact parallel by any means, but broadly speaking, during the civil wars of the 1640s, the royalists drew their strongest support from northern and western Britain, which tended to be the more remote areas from London and more rural and more conservative in attitudes on the whole. And we'd seen that in other instances of history as well, like the Pilgrimage of Grace in Tudor times in the north against the kind of rapid introduction of Protestantism. And so it's tended to be up to the Industrial Revolution, certainly tended to be on the social conservative side of debates. So was in the Civil War, Parliament drew its support mainly from London, the southeast, and the emerging towns and cities. So, and it was quite similar for Brexit. It's not there are places where we're on opposite sides, but most of the Brexit support was predominantly northern and again western again, the more socially conservative areas. Now, the issues are different, but they do at least suggest that there is a kind of social and cultural divide that tends to recur throughout history.
It's something that's not comfortable. It doesn't feel comfortable. The very idea that, and it just shows the complexity of everything. Rochdale, the birthplace of cooperation, the what with a strong, strong radical tradition going back to the Peterloo and the Chartists and coming forward with kind of its largely Kashmiri population who have brought another sense of radicalism to it. The Labour Party in Rochdale is very much bound up in Kashmiri politics, and I think so. The idea that this is where possibly Brexit. I still don't understand why people in Rochdale voted for Brexit. Having knocked on hundreds of doors, been shouted at so many times, been chased down paths, I still don't understand it. And I suppose what made me think was that section in the book, just
I think a lot of it is resentment about being told what to do by the London-based governing class.
Absolutely.
But one of the most surprising things I discovered in researching Northerners, and it comes through in the Manchester book as well, is the extent of the working class Tory voting tradition in Lancashire. quite different from Yorkshire and the Northeast, very strongly historically working class Tory. It came up particularly with the extension of the franchise gradually to all male voters in the second half of the 19th century. Reasons for it get debated, but it probably has quite a lot to do with hostility to Irish Catholic immigration, particularly in Liverpool, which to a lot of people's surprise was dominated by the Tory Party from the 1840s right until the 1970s. People think of it as a left-wing Labour city. That's more recent. It's the it, but it, the religious thing did was predominant in its past.
And I guess that, oh, you say, partly based on Irish, the response to Irish immigration. We've got the same in Lancashire mill towns now, that we have that undercurrent of resentment about the particularly the Asian immigration, which is now 2 generations ago, on the whole, and it's still there.
Yeah, they haven't got used to the Irish yet.
No, give us a while. It's too soon to say, is it? So who said that? I can't remember. Okay. I'm going to move on a bit. I'm going to ask you a bit. I'm interested in your new book. I want to know a bit more about it. So could you just give us a little bit about where it came from, where the idea came from, and what some of your conclusions, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is the cover of the new book, Made in Manchester,
Excellent.
A People's History of the City That Shaped the Modern World. The genesis for it is when we were talking about what to do next. It was my publisher's idea to my publisher, Harper North, a Northern Manchester-based imprint of HarperCollins that came along just at the right time for me in 2020 and published Northerners. And they suggested, why don't you have a go at the history of Manchester? Which I was pleased to do. It's my city, and obviously I know a fair bit about it already, and I'd done a certain amount of research for Northerners, but it was great to go into more detail. So it's been terrific fun to do. I mean, there are some different the kind of differences from Northerners are there's a bit less early history in it just because there isn't so much. So it pretty much. The first two chapters deal from the Romans up to the just before the Industrial Revolution. And you're into the Industrial Revolution by chapter three, rather than a third the way through the book. And for those who hadn't read Northerners, Northerners is a kind of combination of narrative history and interspersed chapters on social and cultural themes. And there are some more of those in the Manchester book. And it being Manchester, I've done special chapters on science and technology, which is a huge factor in Manchester's history, and also on sport, which is again a big one, and on music, both classical and popular. Because those of all, you can hardly write about Manchester without going into some detail on those things.
Oh wait, how do you? I'm going to go back to where we started. Do you define Manchester as Manchester, or as the conurbation? Is it, or is that too?
Again, I define it very loosely and widely. If you think definitions of the North are controversial, then identity questions around Greater Manchester and its region, as you well know, are even more fraught. It's a very contentious subject. But inevitably, a lot of the book focuses on the cities of Manchester and Salford as the core areas where the Industrial Revolution happened. But I do cover the whole, not just of Greater Manchester, but all of anywhere that kind of looks to Manchester as its nearest big city. So I've got 50 odd talks and events planned over the coming months, and And some of them are a bit outside what you'd conventionally think of as the Manchester area. So I've done one in Congleton, south of Cheshire. Kind of identifies with Manchester because it became a commuter railway route. I've got one in Todmorden, which is over the border in my only Yorkshire booking so far.
Oh,
But
no.
it's quite tied in with North Manchester in many ways,
It is.
especially
I
Rochdale.
lived in Todmorden for 5 years and
Yeah.
loved it and always felt it was a Lancashire town. Yeah, it just
Yeah.
definitely, yeah.
I mean, an example of the kind of complexity of these issues around Manchester is that I was born in Stretford Memorial Hospital in a what was at the time a county borough of Lancashire. But until I was five, we actually lived just over the border in Whalley Range, which is part of Manchester, which itself, of course, is part of historic Lancashire. Then we moved for most of my childhood to Stretford proper. And then we moved in my teenage years to Sale, which was in historic Cheshire, at the time part governed by Cheshire County Council. Then I left the region for several decades and came back, and now I live in Saddleworth, which is in historic West Riding of Yorkshire, but also administratively now part of Oldham Borough and thus part of Greater Manchester. So it's a complicated thing, and
It
people
is.
have very strong views on the, particularly the old generation, have strong views. But as I said, I think people can have multiple identities, and personally, I don't have much difficulty thinking of myself as a Stretfordian, a Mancunian, a Lancastrian, and a Northerner, and all those things have some meaning for me.
And I think I have the same, that I was born in Wigan, but mostly brought up in Rochdale, and I can switch from being a Wiganer to a Rochdalian based on what's best for me in any particular moment. So if I meet someone from Wigan, I'll say, "Oh, I'm from Wigan." Then the next person I might, yeah. So you have these layers of identity. So when is the book coming out?
May the 23rd.
Right.
So it's it's been a obviously I worked on it rather faster than I worked on it with Northerners, but I was already part way there when I began. So it took me a year to do.
It is so confusing, and yet somehow in the book you manage to make it seem like it's coherent in some way, which I think is quite an achievement. And I'm reminded, I always remember, I'll always quote this very often, that when Christopher Eccleston was Doctor Who and Rose Tyler was his assistant, Rose Tyler said to him, "If you're an alien, why have you got a northern accent?" And Doctor Who said, "Because every planet has a north."
Yes, I remember that quote as well. Very good
And I
indeed.
think that is fantastic. And I think that's what we should hang on to. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, Martin. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Changing the Record podcast. For all previous episodes and for the latest news, views, and nostalgia for Greater Manchester, check out our website, talkingaboutmygeneration.co.uk.